This is Jim Inkster. Today on the show, in our farewell program at this time, we'll visit with John Word of the Advocate and also hear from Ernest Gaines, if everything goes according to plan, about the Louisiana Book Festival that is slated tomorrow at the Capitol, with a number of literary luminaries from throughout the United States converging at the Capitol. Also, we're scheduled to hear from Denny McClain, the last man to win 30 games in a major league season. At the age of 24, he won the Cy Young Award, and pitched 336 innings in the regular season and 17 more in the World Series. He has some comments about Madison Bumgarner, the phenom for the San Francisco Giants, who just led San Francisco to its third World Series championship in 5 years. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 297-5633 locally, outside the area 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Happy Halloween, and in studio is John Wirt, entertainment writer for The Advocate, who covers movies and music and all kinds of things happening in this community and beyond. And now he is a noted author with a great story about a great Louisiana musician. And John Wirt, tomorrow you will be at the book festival appropriately.
That's right, Jim. Yeah, I've never been at the book festival as an author because I'm a first-time author, unlike a lot of the people you talk to on the show, such as the great Ernest Gaines, who's, I know everybody's looking forward to hearing from him. I will say that I aspire to some sort of literary accomplishment with this book about Huey Piano Smith, the New Orleans musician who had the hits Rockin' Pneumonia, the Boogie Woogie Flu, High Blood Pressure, Don't You Just Know It, and he is the man responsible for Sea Cruise as well.
Well, he's kind of a reclusive fellow, isn't he?
He's dropped out of music in 1981, and before that he dropped out of music about 1970. He became a Jehovah's Witness and devoted himself to study of the Bible. He's a very, very devout person. And the music business was difficult for him, and that a lot of that is in the book.
Well, because of his non-accessibility, he's not the easiest target to choose for your first biography. How did that process evolve?
Well, I think a window opened. He does talk to people sometimes, and through the years he's done a number of interviews. He became more difficult to reach, and his wife, Margaret, said that he just didn't feel like talking to anyone anymore, or that he talked enough or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. At one point, because people, you know, continuously asked for interviews.
And he's in this community.
Yes, yes, he lives here. He's been here since about 1980, and he moved up here from New Orleans and started a new life, basically.
A legend in our midst, and John Word has detailed the life and times of Huey Piano Smith. You've gotten outstanding reviews for the book that was published by LSU Press, but I guess because of the fact that Huey Piano Smith has been absent from the music scene for a while, it's not gaining the kind of attention that you would receive, let's say, if you wrote a book about Madonna.
Or a book about Jerry Lee Lewis, for instance.
Correct.
Who was very much here and performing. He was on David Letterman the other night, Jerry Lee Lewis. Rick Bragg is going to be at the book festival tomorrow. And Rick has written this biography, or semi-autobiography, of Jerry Lee Lewis. Mm-hmm. So, Lewis never dropped out of music, even though he almost destroyed his career and essentially did destroy it for a bit with his rather scandalous marriage to his 13-year-old cousin.
Mm-hmm. That'll usually do it. But he came back with a vengeance and also survived some personal habits that were not the best for longevity. Good genes in that family. He and Jimmy Swaggart and Mickey Gilly have managed to keep on trucking despite full lives.
Jerry Lee Lewis is a survivor, whereas so many people around him are gone, including members of his family. I know Rick Bragg covers some of that in the book. I saw Rick Bragg speak at the Southern Festival of Books in Nashville about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he had a very large crowd, and they had their book festival also at the state capitol, complex, and Bragg spoke at a in a large auditorium.
Well,
he was almost full.
He was on this show, and he told quite a story of being at Jerry Lee Lewis's bedside the last few years, taking notes.
I heard the show. Great show.
Well, John interviews a lot of people, and he sees a lot of concerts and movies. And thus far in 2014, what are some of the highlights?
Well, this is the fall season for movies, and the season where typically you see the more serious films. During the summer, all the blockbusters and the sci-fi special effects films and so on are the box office is crowded with those movies. But yeah, again, we see some more serious films this time of year, such as Birdman, which opens today in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Birdman, starring Michael Keaton, and it's a very serious movie, but it's fun too. It's a crazy kind of story about this actor who played a superhero years and years before this story takes place. And he dropped out of that role. He didn't want to play Birdman anymore. And, of course, Michael Keaton, in fact, in reality, played Batman in two movies. So you have a little parallel there. And I think it's an excellent film, and Michael Keaton probably has a chance at an Oscar nomination for this.
Well, you've seen some concerts this year. Any in particular that are highlights above others?
Well, I did go to see One Direction at the Superdome. One Direction is a young group of four young guys from Britain and one guy from Ireland. And they form this singing group, and they're hugely popular with kids, you know, maybe from the ages of girls from the ages of 6 to 16 or so. And I think the show was sold out. So if you sell out the Superdome for a concert, you're selling a lot of tickets. So I did see that. But the show that I deeply regret that I did not see is Paul McCartney at the Smoothie King Center, as it is now called. And I understand a certain Jim Inkster was at the show, and I wish I had been. I was in Nashville at the Southern Festival Book, so it was a real heartbreaker for me. Because, of course, as I tell everybody, my sad story about I did not see the Beatles in 1966, even though I was told my dad was going to take me. But he just didn't, you know, parents is not that important to them, and they have a lot on their mind. I understand all that. So that was one of my great disappointments in childhood, not seeing the Beatles. But I have seen Paul McCartney play five times before this show at the Smoothie King. So, Jim, why don't you give me your review of the Paul McCartney show?
He put on an amazing tour de force performance that lasted 3 hours and 40 songs.
Wow.
The pyrotechnics, and he never left the stage either. Never took a drink of water, other than for the encores. Presumably, he went backstage and went to the water fountain. But it was an amazing performance for anybody. But he's 72 years old.
He is 72,
and he's
years
a billionaire. He doesn't. He could have done 15 songs and walked off the stage, and I think everyone would have been happy. But he decided to put on a concert for the ages.
A lot of people said that John Lennon was the driving force behind the Beatles, and indeed, I think it began with John Lennon. But Paul was the second guy to come along, and John Lennon selected Paul to be his partner in the Beatles. And then the others came later, George Harrison and Ringo Starr.
They had this Lennon-McCartney thing that went on everything they wrote, and McCartney, I think, wrote more than Lennon and sang more songs than John Lennon with the Beatles, but it says Lennon-McCartney, and for one song, Paul McCartney requested Yoko Ono to change it to McCartney-Lennon. That was Yesterday.
Yesterday.
And she refused.
Well, that's interesting because I think we mentioned this on our 50th anniversary City Park Beatles show that we did back in September. Paul McCartney wrote Yesterday. I don't think John Lennon contributed any lick. And there's no other Beatle on the record. Paul is the only Beatle on that record because it's Paul singing, Paul playing acoustic guitar, and a string quartet arranged by their producer, George Martin. It's basically Paul, nothing else.
Yeah, he deserves more seems credit to be than
ungenerous
given,
of Yoko but. Not to do that one. But that was their deal. We would call everything Lennon McCartney.
Mm-hmm. And Paul McCartney got credit for Strawberry Fields Forever. That was John Lennon.
Really? I don't know about this, because that's totally John Lennon. I don't think that there's any McCartney
says,
in that.
It says Lennon McCartney.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's true.
So it worked both ways. But they both were great, and Paul McCartney, it's hard to believe, is he's still going strong 34 years after the death of John Lennon.
He's a trooper, and he's just still got this fire, not only the fire for performing, but the fire for creating new music, and his new album is called New, mm-hmm. and it's got some great stuff on it, and he collaborates with four young producers, including the son of George Martin.
And he produced one album with the Wings in New Orleans, in Gentilly, at a studio.
That's right, Venus and Mars.
So
early 70s, 73, I think.
He has some experience in that city, and perhaps that's why he pulled out all the stops. 50 years after arriving the first time for the first concert in New Orleans with the Beatles on September 16th, 1964, McCartney was back, and back in a very big way with a sold-out crowd on a football night as LSU was playing Florida on October the 11th.
Nothing's more important than football in Louisiana. That's what they say.
Well, you've been with us many times through the last several years, and change happens. And as of Monday, I'll be doing a show in a different place at a different time. But I want to thank you for all the contributions you've made to our program. You were even with me when Ann Coulter hung up the phone a few years ago.
Really?
You were in studio that day.
I don't know about
that. I remember
that.
I needed somebody to talk to after she went away. So John worked.
I was here at the time of Katrina, mm-hmm. when everyone realized what had happened. So we were right in the thick of it. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be already scheduled for that day. And so I said, Jim, do you really want me to come in? And you said, yeah, come on in. And so I was on here with C.B. Forgotston, who had lost his home. Right. And he was in this great despair. It was quite a, you know, what a crazy time that was.
It was. And that was 9 years ago. But tomorrow, John Wirt will be at the Book Festival. And you'll be there at what time, John?
Do you have that? Is it 3:30?
I think it's 3:30 in... It's one of the House committee rooms, so John will be there along with many others, including Ernest Gaines, who we'll hear from in just a bit. But we thank you, and don't be a stranger.
Thank you.
We're joined now by Dennis Dale McLean, the last major league pitcher to win 30 games in a season. He won 31 in 1968. In fact, he's the last pitcher to win more than 27 games in a season. And in the year of 68, Denny McLean, he pitched 336 innings in the regular season and another 16 and two-thirds in the World Series. And very few people were talking about what he was doing to his arm. Now, some are talking about what happened with Madison Bumgarner, the phenom for the San Francisco Giants, who worked over 52 innings in the postseason this year and pitched on short rest in the World Series in Game 7, 5 innings in relief just a few days after going the distance in Game 5. Denny McLean, your thoughts about Bumgarner and the Giants?
It's good to talk to you, first of all. And you hit one of my buttons right away, Ann Coulter. And I think, I won't comment politically this morning, but... Lord Almighty, where the heck did she ever come from? Anyway, the World Series was the best playoff baseball I've seen in 30, 40 years, I think. I said it was the best I've seen since 68. Obviously, I'm a little partial towards 68. But we were down 3-1 in that series, and we come back and won it. But this was so exciting with watching these two teams, and we're so evenly matched. But what people don't realize is both teams, Jimmy, they got hot at the same time, San Francisco and Kansas City. And what I told everybody was, I said, I'm picking San Francisco before it started. And I said, if they get to the World Series, the bottom line is, I think they'll sweep it. Which, of course, I was wrong, but they won it.
We'll be back in 90 seconds with the great Denny McLean, two-time Cy Young Award winner. He won the Most Valuable Player Award, too, in 1968. And... we'll talk about whether National League is going to make the right choice on that award. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 and 877-217-5757, wherever you are. And we are rejoining Denny McClain, the great from the Detroit Tigers, who won two Cy Young Awards, a Most Valuable Player Award, and 31 games in 1968, all before he was 25 years old, or at 25 he had done all this, and 320-win seasons in that period as well. And he was piling up the innings and the pitch counts, and people were thinking it would go on forever. And Madison Bumgarner defied what is now conventional wisdom and pitched 52 in some two-thirds innings in the World Series and in other playoff games this year, and he did well. He was unstoppable in the postseason, and the Giants, for the third time in 5 years, are champions of the world. This brings back a lot of memories of 1968 when Denny McClain and Mickey Lolich pitched on short rest, and pitchers didn't seem to bother. There was no real concern.
You know, first of all, let me point out, as soon as I mentioned Ann Coulter's name, we had a problem with the line. So Ann is around someplace.
The Gremlins.
First of all, you know, yeah, they pitched 50 innings in the postseason. Well, we never had an opportunity to pitch 50 innings. We only played a 7-game series. It was the winner of the National League versus the American League. So when somebody really gets rolling in the postseason now, they can really make an impact on the game. I mean, I have never in my life heard so many great things said about one guy. I mean, listen, guys, everybody out there, I played with Koufax. I played with Gibson. I played with Lolich. I played with Don Drysdale, and I got news for you. And this kid is a good pitcher. Don't misunderstand me. But when you start putting guys at that level of the greatness that was around in the 60s and early 70s, you know, it's a little early. Let me point out one thing. He was 25 years old this year and had a hell of a year, great year, and he's the reason they won it, no question about it. He's had 7 games in his entire major league career. By the age of 25, most of the guys I just mentioned had 70 or 80 or 90 or maybe 100 complete games. I mean, that's the dramatic difference in the game. So I always am a little, not offended or insulted, but I'm always taken back that nobody wants to add a little caveat that Don Drysdale had 59 or 1,000 scoreless innings 1 year. I mean, it's crazy that they want to take it to such a plateau. And the guy's 25. Let's see what happens over the next 5 years. Then we can determine what kind of a pitcher he is. Because, Jimmy, as you know, and I certainly know, injuries play such a dramatic part. And when I tore my rotator cuff and then severed it eventually, life stops at that point in time. And you'll never find out how many games you could have won. But injuries are a part of the game, as we all know. And the bottom line simply is, yes, he had a great series. And I picked the Giants because of him, also because of the experience they've had in the last, the other World Series that they had played in. And there's no replacement for experience. Although, I will tell you this, Kansas City came pretty close this year. And Brett is a good friend of mine, and I was thrilled for him. But on the other hand, I just thought that the Giants were going to win it gung-ho. And I made that prediction before it even started. And remember, Kansas City and the Giants were the two teams that barely made it into the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So, this is the first time that's happened, too. And it was great for baseball. I don't remember one bad game in these playoffs. Yeah, there was a blowout here or a blowout there, but I'm telling you, the baseball was sensational. And the defense between these two teams for the last 7 games was extraordinary. It's some of the greatest defense I've seen in many years.
Well, Denny McClain was on a great team in 1968, and it's hard to believe it's been 46 years, and he was only 24 at the time, with Al Kaline and Bill Freehan and Mickey Lolich and many other fantastic players. And you were the most valuable player in the regular season, as you should have been, and the Cy Young Award winner. Now, this year in the National League, the NL MVP and Cy Young Awards will be won by Clayton Kershaw, who was
Don't bet on it. Do not bet on that, because you got the guy with the Dodgers that everybody thought was the next god on the mound, and he is the one that got all the votes up. And I think they vote for the MVP before the playoffs
they do.
Started. So do not doubt for a second that Kershaw may win the MVP.
That's what I'm saying. He will win it.
He will
win it. And the question I was going to ask you is, why don't they wait until after the postseason to cast
ballots? Because you don't have anybody. Jimmy, it's easy. Because they don't have any other teams playing. If everybody was still playing, then I think that would be fair, and we'd be able to see what will Kershaw do over the next 52 innings, much like Baumgartner. And, you know, that type of thing. But Kershaw, twice in a row he caved in. And so I don't know if that says something about his ability to stand and protect the league, or did he just run out of gas? Because I will tell you, and I'll suggest to you in the strongest terms, nobody runs out of gas in the World Series or the playoffs. I mean, we had an event here in Detroit last year. When our Detroit Tigers in 2013 were playing the Boston Red Sox, Scherzer, who was certainly our best pitcher at the time with the Tigers, and probably is this year too, Scherzer, after striking out four guys in a row against Boston with a lead of three or four runs, asked to come out of the game. He said he was out of gas. Now, those are the games that you become iconic. You become so good to the general public, and especially to your fans, that, in fact, you've got to stay in the game. And this guy asked to come out, and I'll tell you why he asked to come out. He doesn't like pitching with a lead after the sixth or seventh inning because he's afraid he's going to lose it. He did it numerous times again this year. He should have been a 20-some game winner this year. He lost at least three, maybe four games this year. I know for three for certain, and I think it was four, where he had leads in the seventh inning and the eighth inning and asked to come out of the game, and then our bullpen, which leaked a little bit anyway, they lost the game, and he didn't get the win or the loss after that because he was out of the game. Now, especially with our bullpen, our bullpen was, to say the least, on a scale of 1 to 10, on a good day, a 4 or 5 chance of holding a lead. So, to think that you want to come out of the biggest game in your life, Boston, and we had Verlander pitching the next day, I mean, was just nuts. And that's the reputation, of course, he has. And that's the reason he's not going to get a $200 million contract. He's going to get some money. Don't misunderstand me. And, of course, as you and I both know, he must have been drinking real heavy the day that he turned down $150 million last year. So think about that. Yeah, he turned down a deal last year, 6 years, for $150 million. Think about that.
Guaranteed. Guaranteed money.
Guaranteed. All baseball money is guaranteed, folks. You cannot give a player a maybe contract. They are all guaranteed. $150 million.
Well, didn't Kershaw get like $31 million this season?
$31 million Kershaw earned this year, and I guess his contract is calling in almost $300 million. And let me point it out. I'll put it in real black and white terms for you, and everybody gets a kick out of this. I played 10 years. In my 10 years, well, let me back it up a second. Kershaw earned, if he only pitched 200 innings this year, he made $150,000 an inning. $150,000 every inning he pitched. Kershaw, when they played their first game this past year in Japan, the Dodgers went over there to play the first game of the season in Japan. His first three innings he pitched, he made more money in the first three innings this season than I made my entire career. He made $450,000, I made $440,000 my entire career. I mean, what drama, huh?
Well, and he's 26. By the time you were 26, you had two Cy Young Awards, a Most Valuable Player Award, a 31-game season, a 24-game season. But you also had blown your arm out.
Yeah, I couldn't hardly get my arm to the backside of my body to take care of personal issues. That's how bad it hurt. So, it was dramatic. And you know, those are the days that we would pitch on 2 days' rest a couple times, three, four times a year. I mean, Mickey Lolich and I pitched six of the seven games in the World Series in 1968. People don't remember that. But we pitched six of them. We each Mickey and I started every 2 days, and we had one guy get in the middle of us, Earl Wilson, because he and I were just on one day at that time, and certainly you can't pitch every other day. Although they did it in the dead ball era, which is a whole different story. But, yeah, it was the game was a little bit more. See, the other thing, too, back then, we hit. And there are strategic places in a game where you can make that change. You don't have to wait for 100 pitches or, you know, 120 pitches. You make it when you got a couple men on first and second, second and third, and you got the pitcher coming up with one out and you don't have the lead, you pinch it for them. Today, they don't have that option.
Yeah, you like the designated hitter?
No, I think it's. This is what I want. I either want the designated hitter in both leagues, or I don't want it. Period. I don't think you can play the game two different ways. And I really believe the National League has an advantage if they are the home team in a World Series. Of course, this year they weren't. But the bottom line is, I think it's unfair. I just think totally it's unfair. Maybe one year you do all DH, and maybe the next year you don't do the DH. But I think you got to level the playing field a little bit more, because pitchers who don't ever get a chance to hit, and all of a sudden you're taking batting practice every day the week before you're going to be in the playoffs, I think it's unfair. I just think it's a different game at that point in time for the American League team.
The Giants only won 88 games. They were a wild card team, but they beat the Pirates, the Nationals, the Cardinals, and the Royals. They were the best team at the time when it was decided. But what about the wild card? Has that been good for baseball?
I think it's been great for baseball. I don't think one game should decide it either. I think they got to take it to a best of five, and let's see what happens. And then the next line, where they're now doing the best of five, I think you need to put it to the best of seven. Now, that creates another problem, the weather, because if you wind up with two teams that are outside in late November, you may be shoveling snow. We're supposed to have snow up here in Detroit today, God forbid. here we are. It's still October for a few more hours, and they're predicting snow tonight. So not a great deal of it, but you know what? That's a bad day when you see that first snow. Just horrible.
You've seen a few of them.
I sure have.
Back in your day, all the World Series games were daytime, and I think the audience probably on television was larger. The TV ratings for this series, other than Game 7, were not good. But as a purist, did you like it when you played the games in daytime? People were skipping school and skipping work to watch the series?
No. I was a night guy. I loved pitching the first game of a doubleheader when the hitter could not see the ball very well. And I loved pitching at night. And in certain environments like Anaheim, Anaheim and on the West Coast, it always gets, because all those parks are built into a hole in the ground, as you know, most stadiums are. And back then, the new ones were the only ones in a hole, and it got damp in there. And with my fastball that I had, I was able to pitch up all the time. That's where I was most effective. So in these damper settings, I was much more effective. And I love the cold weather and that type of stuff. So. But once it gets under, 50 degrees, 45 degrees, it's a different test, because you got to really take care of yourself and make sure you're loose between innings all the time, because that's the biggest fear. And the first time I hurt my shoulder was in a game in Minnesota, and it was in the middle of the summer when one of those horrible cold waves went through there on a Sunday afternoon. And me, the idiot I can be from time to time, we went extra innings, and I was either in the 11th or 12th inning. And lo and behold, that's when I heard it the first time. I mean, I was just out there too long. Because you know what? Every time you get a chance to win a ball game, you want to win it. And you don't want to walk away when you're still tied 1-1 or 2-2, whatever it was. And I've always just believed that when you're out there and you're in a tie, you got to take it to the end. And unfortunately, that Sunday I probably should have. Because it dropped like 28 or 30 degrees in about 25 minutes, they said that day. And you could feel it. You know, you could feel the cold take you over.
Well, in other sports, the players are bigger, faster, stronger, and you've got Bumgarner, who's 6'5 and 235, but I'm not sure if he throws as hard as you did in your prime when you were pitching at, what, about 6 feet and 185 pounds?
Yeah, well, 6 feet, about 215 or 220. My best success was after I got to about 215 pounds. Although my success had a lot to do with bowling too. I learned that bowling was, and I didn't realize at the time for a while, but I realized bowling had an awful lot to do with my legs. It taught me how to push. It told me, showed me how to slide, and I didn't even know it for the first year. And all of a sudden, I picked up so many miles per hour in my fastball. I said, "Hell, I'm going to go bowl again." And in the winter of '67, I was bowling 100 lines per day during the winter. And that is a true story. And so all of a sudden I got stronger. And certainly it was my right arm that got so much stronger, but it made me stronger on the right side. It gave me more velocity. it did, and it, what it really made me do is it made me pitch more and more with my legs, and of course, it that allowed me to have more complete games, and you control your own destiny at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And so that's where my success came from, and I had the greatest pitching coach in the history of the game, Johnny Sain. Nobody knew the game the way he did. I mean, they can talk about all these guys all over the game, but nobody comes close to Johnny Sain. And if anybody out there wants to Google Johnny Sain, look up his career as a pitching coach. By the way, Johnny Sain was a legitimate superstar. And when he played in Milwaukee, the saying was, spawn in Sain and pray for rain.
Yeah, they were.
That's how good they were.
Quite
and
a tandem.
Sain, if you take a look at Johnny Sain and see how many 20-game winners he produced as a pitching coach, you'll be shocked.
And you tried everything once your arm went out. You had quacks all over the country shooting stuff into you, didn't you?
I'll tell you, some guy when I was traded to Oakland, they said, listen, we got a real good doctor out here in California. It's a hell of an orthopedic guy, and he'll give you the injection that you're looking for. And it was cortisone is what I thought. And they said he can't come in today because he's not feeling well. Could you go to his apartment and he'll have his stuff there because he's a doctor, what have you, whatever. So I walked in, and Jim, the first thing he said to me, Mr. McLean, how are you? Good to see you. And he said, I'm here to fix you. And he said, would you take off all your clothes and I'll get ready for this injection? I said, what? Then I'm thinking, what the hell kind of an injection is this guy talking about? So I said, Doc, I'm not quite sure if this is what I'm, what are we doing here? Why am I taking all my clothes off? He said, well, it'd just be more sterile, and it'll be this, and they gave me about 7 or 8 reasons. And I said, you know what, I'm going to come back. I said, I'll give you a call either later today or see you at the clubhouse tomorrow. But I said, I'm just not comfortable. And I quickly got to the door, got in my car, and never looked back. And I never saw the guy again, as a matter of fact. I never saw him in a clubhouse again, so I don't know what was going on. I've been around a lot of crazy people in my life. This may have been just one more.
Should Bonds be in the Hall of Fame?
I believe so. I believe the only sin that that you should be barred from the Hall of Fame is if you bet on the game of baseball. I believe that's the one. I believe Bonds will get in the Hall of Fame one day. I don't know if he'll be alive. I have no idea, but I believe he'll get in one day. I believe Clements will get in one day because they were stars long before they started abusing all of the things that they used to enhance their careers. The only guy I don't think that will ever get in the Hall of Fame, and I say this with all candor, and he's a friend of mine, is Pete Rose. He bet on the game, and if you read the 221-page report that the Dowry Commission ordered by baseball, and baseball didn't want to nail Pete Rose. He was the face of baseball. He was Mr. Hustle. He was Charlie Hustle. And lo and behold, they had to do what they had to do because not only did he bet on the game, but if you read the betting ledgers, and they had plenty of betting ledgers and betting slips, it certainly appears without, you would not doubt if for a fact that he bet against the Cincinnati Reds. I'm telling you, if you read it, that's what it looks like.
Well, Denny, thank you for joining us, and it's always a pleasure, and you still talk as fast as you used to throw.
Well, I appreciate that, Big Jim, and you're still doing a hell of a job, and keep everything safe in Louisiana. I love it down there.
We'll be back after this 90-second pause. Thank you, Denny. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, in our final segment for this hour, and at least for a while, my final show on WRKF. And with us is a man I met because I was given the privilege of being on the air at this time for 11 years now, or almost. Ernest Gaines, the Louisiana literary legend, and he will be at the book festival tomorrow, and he listens on occasion, I'm honored to say, in his beautiful home across the river in New Roads. Good morning, Ernest Gaines.
Morning, Jim.
Nice to talk with you.
Give me a man.
Well, we were just talking with Denny McLean about the Giants winning third time in 5 years the World Series. You lived out in San Francisco when they had Mays and McCovey and Marichal.
Yep.
And they never won.
I was there. I remember the day they drove in. I remember the day they came to San Francisco. It was 1958. I was working downtown San Francisco in an insurance company when they graded from the down through the business district out to the old Seal Stadium.
Seal Stadium. That was before Candlestick.
Oh, yeah, before the Candlestick. They were at Seal Stadium for a while, I think a couple of years, I suppose. And I remember the date, and it was a very small stadium there, Seal Stadium. But, man, it was so much better than Candlestick Park. Candlestick Park was the coldest place that you've ever played baseball. And Mark Twain had it right, man. Very, very cold.
But the coldest summer the coldest winter I ever had was a summer in San Francisco, right?
And now I've seen many, many of those because I used to go to all the games at that time. I had a friend who was a newspaper man. He wrote for the Examiner, and he'd always get tickets. So I had tickets anytime I wanted to go to the game. I'd haul them all the time.
Baseball is a great game for a writer. You can kind of daydream on occasion, and of course the pageantry is subtle and just begs for some kind of literary touch.
Baseball is great when you're at the game. I don't care too much for baseball, except for the World Series at home watching it on television. But to be out there and in the sun or the case in Candlestick Park in the wind. It was always great because you're around people and yelling and eating peanuts or popcorn or whatever, you know, and talking. So it's really a fantastic game.
Mm-hmm. Denny McClain mentioned Don Drysdale. I remember the rivalry was fierce between the Dodgers and the Giants. And Drysdale used to throw at the great Willie Mays, didn't he?
Yeah, but Drysdale would never, ever throw at Willie McCovey. Because but Willie McCovey must have told Drysdale, don't. And he did. But Mays, he went for Mays every time Mays came up there. Mays would fall back. He'd throw his bat in one way, and his helmet would go one way, and his body would go the other way to get away from that Drysdale fastball. But they were rivals, man. They brought it from New York, and they took it to San Francisco and to Los Angeles. And they were just great teams to watch. I used to, we had Marichal at the time. And I thought, I still think Koufax must be the greatest pitcher I've ever seen play. He played about 10 years. 10 years were bad, but the last, 5 years were bad. But the last 5 years, nobody could hit this guy. He was the most beautiful pitcher I've ever seen. Although I liked Marichal, because he's on our team, but I think Koufax was just about the greatest pitcher I've ever seen.
Well, Marichal was a pitcher for the ages himself, but he had the misfortune of pitching in the league at the same time as Koufax and Bob Gibson. But in those last 5 years, you note Koufax, he won 111 games.
Yeah.
He was unstoppable. But you have written about many things, primarily about Louisiana, even when you were in San Francisco, and despite the lure that city has and the joy you had in it, you came back home many years ago, and you've never really looked back, have you?
No, I haven't. You know, I keep, whenever I have an interview with some newspaper people or talking to students, I always tell them that I left Louisiana in 1948, because I couldn't go to school around here. There was no school for African-Americans, high school or junior high school for African-Americans here. And I left in 1948 to go join my mother and my stepfather in Vallejo, California, and go to school. But I came back here really sort of to stay. Well, a long visit in 1963. And I think those are the two most important days of my life. The day I left California, Louisiana, to go to California for my education. And the day I came back here to Louisiana because of the writing. It was 15 years. very definitely two important days of my life. I went to California, but I tell them that I went to California. My body went to California. My soul stayed here because my people have lived right here in this same area where I'm sitting now for the last five generations. And everything I know of my history is from here. And my folks are all buried back there in the cemetery here, the River Lake Plantation Cemetery. So everything was here. Everything was here. But I had to go for the education. I had to go there to study American literature, English literature, to study writing, just to study to get an education. But I had to come back here and to be the writer that I am today.
Well, tomorrow, Ernest Gaines will be featured in House Committee Room. It's actually in the House Chamber. At 1 o'clock, Keith Clark will be interviewing him, and he will be at the House Chamber right after James Carville and Mary Madeline and Rick Bragg, and then later Charles Blow of the New York Times will round out the afternoon in the House Chamber. And there are many others who will also be on hand tomorrow who have been literary stalwarts in this state and beyond. But Ernest, it's become an annual tradition for you. I know you're always pleased to go to the Capitol.
Well, you know, Jim, for a while there, I couldn't go to the festival because of the conflict between the book festival and the our Cemetery Beautification Day. I've told that to different people that I had to go to a Cemetery Beautification Day because everything I write about around those people buried back there about three-quarters of a mile from where I'm sitting here now, under those pecan trees, those are the ones that give me the inspiration to write. And that's all I could write about. And though my wife and I, Diane and I, keep the cemetery in good shape during the entire year. On Cemetery Beautification Day, we get people from those people are buried back there. They come from Washington State, from California, they come from all over the country. We gather there at that particular day. That's the last day of October.
Last Saturday
in October. The Saturday before La Toussaint, and that we get everybody to come to work, to clean up the graves, to whitewash the graves, the stones, and, just bring flowers, and then after that, after the work is done, 3 or 4 hours, we all gather here at the house, and we have a big eat-out. So that day was in conflict with the festival there in Baton Rouge, so I couldn't give up cemetery beautification because everything I write about and of my writing and made me the writer I am because of those who are buried back there, and now I'm very happy to be part of the festival, book festival tomorrow, and I'll do my best.
Well, we'll look for you tomorrow, 1 o'clock at the Capitol, and thanks for all these years of friendship with you and your beautiful wife.
Well, Jim, we're sorry to hear that you're leaving us, man. I don't know anything that make us better. And your fans, because you have thousands of fans who listen to you between 9 and 10, and I don't know what we're going to do in that hour from now on, and who are your fans going to be that 4 o'clock period going into.
Well, it'll be a change, but I'll just call you up at 9 o'clock every day. How's that? Thanks again, Ernest, and see you and Diane tomorrow, and thanks for what you've done for this state.
Thanks a lot, man.
Take care. Bye-bye. And I'm joined in studio in our remaining time, and if you would like to get in, 297-5633. Rabbi Barry Weinstein is one of those people I knew, but I didn't know that well until I became station manager at WRKF in October of 2003. And then 8 months later, I had a serious accident, and standing over my bed, over my near-dead body, was the rabbi, and he came every day to see me during that time, and we become very good friends. And you know about change.
I do.
You've been through it.
Yes. A little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful to be here with you today.
Well, it's an honor to close it out with you.
I brought a little note, and I brought a gift for WRKF. I know RKF is doing a special fundraiser today, and I give my check to RKF in honor of you and with thanks for all you have done for us, your pursuit of truth and the betterment of us all in our beloved Baton Rouge. And I know for Linda and me, our family, and all of us in the city, we thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Rabbi. And we all try to contribute in various ways. And I don't know of many people who've made more of a contribution than you have to our community over the last 30 or 35 years. And you came from Omaha, Nebraska, of all places.
Yeah, Omaha, Nebraska. And one day I do want to write a piece about the difference between Omaha, Nebraska, wonderful, wonderful city and state in which we lived for 12 years, 12 winters, and life in Louisiana. Much more exciting, Jim, in Louisiana than Nebraska.
I bet you never thought you'd be here as long as you have, though.
I never thought we would be, and I brought one of my favorite pieces from my amateur radio life. a little telegraph key, a Morse code key, because I think of you, I think of radio, RKF, and all you've done, and the progress we've made in American modernity, going from this telegraph key to the magic of radio, and how you've helped bring us all together so beautifully.
Well, it's been my honor to be with you. And to everybody who is listening, you are the reason that I've done this for several years. After moving away, leaving the station as station manager in 2006, it's hard to believe I've been at the Louisiana Radio Network now for 8.5 years doing the show from this location. And it's been a joy because the station is truly a beacon of light in our community, and there's no other station quite like it. And the audience is like no other. And it's been certainly a bigger honor for me than for anybody who has derived any pleasure from this show. It's been quite a picnic being here from 9 to 10, Monday through Friday, for almost 11 years now.
Well, you know, in Jewish life, we have Simchat Torah, which is the rejoicing of the law. We just celebrated it. On that same night, we finished the book of Deuteronomy. And we begin the book of Genesis in the same night, two different Torah scrolls. This is your simcha. This is your joyful time as you now just continue doing what you're doing so well for all of us in Louisiana. I am so excited to look forward to hearing voices and people calling in and your guests and celebrities on a different station, but we'll always hold RKF 89.3. I always miss the point, but with RKF, you get the point.
There you go. You ought to be one of the fundraisers. You're pretty good.
We did that for a while, too.
Yeah, but when I was off the air for a few months after my car accident in 2004, I remember the first show upon return was with you and Joe Tregel, and you showed up in a tuxedo that day.
That's
that was
right.
October 4th of 2004, so that's been 10 years and 27 days.
And if I'd gotten up earlier, I would have put on that tux or at least a nice suit to celebrate you and to wish you God's blessing as you continue on the radio for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Is there any curious thing about closing on Halloween? I'm getting quite a few emails here, and I thank everybody for their sentiments, and it is touching, and change happens, and this is something that in the interest of the company that I run, it is a good move for me personally and for our company. But my heart will always be with WRKF, and I'm sure that there will be great programming throughout the day, as there always is on this station, for the days, months, and years to come.
Well, God bless
and,
you.
And I see several members of the WRKF staff are here, and thank you for showing up. To say so long for a while, David Gordon, the station manager. I see Barbara Clark, Bob Mann, the chairman of the board. So thanks again, everybody, and until next time, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.